Hey guys, welcome to the Martial and Healing Arts channel. I'm Rafe Kelly, founder of Evolve Move Play. I'm extremely excited to be sponsoring this channel. Martial and Healing Arts have been key aspects of embodiment and self-cultivation for thousands of years. I have some of my best friends in the industry, Rory Miller, Matt Thornton, Edward Hines, presenting here, and I'm really excited to share what they have to say with you guys. You're gonna love it. So Evolve Move Play is an ecology of practices of movement, mindfulness, nature connection, and community. And within the movement, we have a big emphasis on moving in nature and being able to do parkour. We also like to lift weights and throw things around, but there's a huge aspect of martial arts, and I've been training martial arts since I was 6 years old. So it's really exciting to be able to sponsor this channel in particular. If you're interested in my work, check out my talks on the Main Stage and the Movement Anatomy channel. If you can't get to either of those live, you can check us out at Rafe Kelly on Instagram, get all your awesome embodiment giveaways, and for now, just enjoy this amazing channel. It's gonna be an awesome show.
Welcome to the Embodiment Conference and our session with Dr. David Shaner. Welcome, David. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Miles. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I'll just make a very short introduction for you and then pass the room to you. Dr. David Shaner has trained for over 50 years and holds the rank of Hachidan, 8th degree black belt, in the Japanese art of Shinshin Toitsu Aikido. He is the chief instructor of the Eastern Ki Federation and is Japan headquarters advisor to Eastern Europe and Russia, where he has taught annually for the past 20 years. Shaner Sensei received his PhD in Japanese philosophy from the University of Hawaii and has taught at Harvard University and Furman University, and currently serves as Herring Professor Emeritus at Furman University. Shaner Sensei has authored 4 books and is the book series editor of the Philosophy of Biology series, with 37 volumes focused upon understanding the biological basis of productive learning and behavior. As a Crown Prince Akihito Scholar, which is a big deal in Japan, Shaner Sensei was granted a personal audience with the Emperor of Japan, His Majesty's Emperor Akihito, which is also a big deal, I can tell you. Today, Shaner Sensei is going to be guiding us in a session. I'll tell you, before I introduce this session, I will say one thing. The ancient Japanese Zen master, samurai Zen master, Isai Chosanshi, was one of these swords masters that went up to Mount Koya and trained with the Tengu, these demon spirits, and he learned the secret esoteric arts. One of the few that went there and was able to come back alive and transformed and to bring the boons, his gifts, to humanity. He said that the mark of a true master is according to this, that they can take the dregs of the ancients and extract clear liquid. And that is a beautiful, sums up David Shaner's work. So today David's gonna be teaching us about living with the wind at your back. Welcome, David Sensei, and I'm looking forward to your session.
Miles, you are so generous. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And thank you, just to let everyone know, I specifically asked if Miles could join me because he's also a very high-level sensei in Aikido, and he's a very disciplined and experienced teacher of meditation, both of which are very relevant to this talk. So I'm going to tell a little story to just kick it off. I was asked by the conference organizers to speak about a discipline called Kyatsu Ryoho, or healing with ki therapy that has been taught to me. And I thought, well, this is going to be really hard to do in like 50 minutes, especially if you aren't sure how to cultivate ki. But then I saw the word healing arts and I thought, you know what? Here's something that most people don't know. When I was 15 years old, I shattered very, very badly my right ankle, tibia, fibula, ankle, just fell apart. And this was 51 years ago, was before they could straighten it out and put in pins. So I was left with a healed leg that was crooked. And I had been living with persistent and chronic pain in my right foot since I was 15 years old. But I have learned ways to navigate that and still live an active life where most people don't even know that this even occurred. But I thought I would use this forum because of something that I'm gonna kind of ask Miles a couple questions here and test my theory. So Miles, in your work, Do you teach people how to focus and sustain that focus?
Yes, I do.
Yes, you do. And do you teach people how to relax, especially under stress?
Yes.
And do you teach people how to connect with themselves and with each other?
Absolutely.
And do you think, what percentage of the presenters at this conference over these 12 days, what percentage do you think in their work, they're also teaching people how to focus, relax, and connect in this embodiment world?
I would say the majority. Some presentations are more academic, so maybe not, but right. The majority are experiential, and that's kind of what they're doing.
Yes. And so I thought, while your background in Buddhist meditation and my background is very similar, it occurs that we're teaching three skills that other people can use to manage a self-care program to help them to manage pain. So if you'll permit me, then I want to jump right into it. I've got a lot to cover, but I want people to be thinking, if you're viewing this, that if you are a facilitator in the embodiment world and you help your clients or students or whatever you call them, if you help them to focus, relax, and connect as part of your modality, then I think you're going to be really interested in what I have to share today.
David, I just want to, sorry to jump in, but I know that you also, maybe after your presentation, but you also wanted to invite people into the room if they want to join us. They're in the webinar format, but if they want to join us,
sure,
they can just raise their hand electronically. There's a button, push the participants button, and you'll see a place to raise your hand. And then we'll invite you into the room. You can sit in the room here with us and engage in the Q&A or whatever comes up.
Great. Yeah, that's great. That's great. Okay, Roma, if I could have the first slide, please. So how about the screen? Is it working for everyone? I'm seeing Miles on the side, not myself. Is that correct?
Yeah. You're on main screen, and it looks. The slides are on the main screen. You're on the side view.
Okay, because I'm seeing you on the side view, but that's great. I have your handsome face to look at. Okay. We went ahead. Let me go back on the agenda. Yeah. Of course, this is just to read it, but I'm going to show you two videos. One is a book trailer, Living with the Wind at Your Back, to set the context, something that Miles has seen before, actually. And then I would like to take you through a short video on the five phases of nociceptive pain to get a little neuroanatomy in your background here. Then I'm going to share three orders of body-mind awareness, which are going to be helpful in managing chronic pain. And then the three skills that I've already mentioned, focus, relax, and connect, to reduce what I call as-felt pain in your daily life. And then finally, we're going to end up with some measurements, because I like empirical data, and I like to try to demonstrate that when you say you're actually reducing pain, you actually can with some sort of evidence-based measures. And that's what I've been working in the last couple of years to develop, and I'd like to share that with you today. So if we could have the very first video, please. This is a book trailer. And the reason why I'm asking you to view it is, if you pay close attention to the script, it's going to describe a worldview that sets the context for what I'd like to share with you today. It's essentially the worldview of monism.
Imagine what your life would be like if each day you felt as though the entire universe was working with you as a steady, powerful, and uplifting ally. Do you think this kind of life is actually possible? Well, it is possible. And understanding how to live this way is as simple as it is profound. The universe has a rhythm. And when you learn to think and act in accord with that rhythm, you begin to live as though your sail is always full. You are living with the wind at your back. Our experience of life is shared. We see, hear, taste, touch, feel, and think about a world that we have in common. However, how we react to the world around us can lead us down two paths. We can either interpret ourselves as being alone, not good enough, or a victim of our circumstances, or we can learn how to be connected and choose to be a positive, empowered individual possessing the tools to live our life in accord with our highest values and aspirations. In my new book, Living with the Wind at Your Back, I describe seven arts to positively transform your life. The seven arts include the art of preparation, the art of compassion, the art of responsibility, the art of relaxation, the art of conscious action, the art of living naturally, and the art of service. While the seven arts exercises will serve as your toolkit, it is your own personal experience that will serve as both beacon and benchmark, helping you to make steady progress towards your goals. The seven arts change process enables you to navigate the ups and downs of your daily life because you will be living in complete harmony with the principles of the universe. I tell stories in this book, drawing from my own eclectic path as a ski racer, a student of the martial art of Ki Aikido, a professor of Asian studies and philosophy, and as a performance development consultant, helping to improve the performance of Fortune 500 businesses, as well as professional athletes and musicians. Throughout my journey, I was asking simple questions and then learning to discover answers by actually testing them. I was looking for universal principles that are practical and work when applied against the test of my own daily life experience. You have to put your answers to the test to see if they really work by applying them at home, at work, and at play. Let's keep it simple. It's possible to go on a personal development retreat for a few days to better yourself, but it is a temporary relief away from the real challenges of your daily life. Lasting change requires a toolkit for daily life, not retreat life. The Seven Arts provides the tools of patience and discipline cultivated drop by drop in the midst of our real life challenges. All that is necessary is for you to put yourself in the right rhythm and relationship with the universe that supports your very existence at every single moment. The truth is, the universe always is and has always been at your back. You are never truly separate and alone. At every precious moment, your life is sustained by your deep connection to the single unifying force of the universe. The good news is that you can experience this connection for yourself. Practicing the seven arts will enable you to function and live in accord with the rhythm of the universe. This is living with the wind at your back. I wish you well on your journey of positive self-transformation.
Okay, are we back?
We're back.
Okay, I can see you, Miles. Can everyone hear me?
Yeah, very good.
Okay, great. So let's go ahead and go to the presentation deck. Okay, next slide, please. So I shared that video to kind of get this context of monism, that virtually everything in this universe is interconnected. And I was pleased to see in this conference a number of presentations already where people were taking an evolutionary perspective on trying to understand human nature and human consciousness and the body, like how we have evolved. Ilan Stefani, I really enjoyed hers, and she referred to an evolutionary perspective. Gabor Mate, the biopsychosocial model. So many different people that I've heard already, you're going to see themes here coming up. Okay, on my screen, the book there is blurry. Can people actually read that slide? Or is it blurry? Is the text blurry?
But we can see it.
You can see it. Okay, maybe it's just mine. So I had the good fortune in 1985 and 86 of receiving a fellowship to teach at Harvard University. My field was comparative philosophy, And I was actually in the Yenching Library studying Buddhism with Masatoshi Nagatomi, this famous Buddhologist. But across the street was the Museum of Comparative Zoology. And the short story is I befriended some very famous scientists because they were doing state-of-the-art work having to do with neuroplasticity that I was very interested in. And so the following year, I was asked to guest edit this peer review journal called the Personalist Forum. And I was very proud to be able to write with Edward O. Wilson, who's the father of sociobiology, and Marvin Minsky. You see there the Society of Mind from MIT. Marvin Minsky is the father of artificial intelligence and the person that first came up with neural networks to understand that model of consciousness that artificial intelligence actually imitates. So at this time, I was steeped in the idea of neuroplasticity because my research question was, why is it that people from different cultures find it so difficult to actually put themselves in the place of other people and actually see the world and understand the world from their perspective? Well, neuroplasticity gave me an opportunity to recognize that while our brain, we're born literally as living embryos, all those axon neuron nodeling structures that get developed postnatally reflect our environment. Next slide, please. all these are blurry to me. Anyway, the next book.
Sorry, David. For me, it's crystal clear.
Okay, great.
A few other people have also said it's blurry, so.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
But it's also okay.
Well, we'll see what happens when I actually have to read the slides coming up. So anyway, following that work, I was just at the right place at the right time. And so that work on understanding the role of neuroplasticity in the development of culturally dependent worldviews was expressed in my second book here with Japan as the different culture to be juxtaposed with Occidental cultures to understand the influence of this neuroplasticity. Next slide, please. Yeah, I can't read that at all. Okay, but fortunately, I know what it is. So in 1990, I published this article in the journal Human Evolution on neoteny. It's called Patamorphic Morphology. But the idea of neuroplasticity was critically important, and I was pleased to see that this really took hold and was taken very seriously to understand the effect of our cultural upbringing, where the brain is developing postnatally. And yet what we thought back then was that this neuroplasticity would stop around the age 25 or 30. The good news is we were wrong. We were thinking that the ceasing of neuroplasticity was what made it so difficult for people to kind of unlearn their own culture and put themselves in the place of other cultures. The good news is we've learned that neural networks continue to be plastic as long as you live. And that has a real significant import here in terms of managing pain. Next slide, please. So by 2005, the world was already figuring this out. This was becoming part of our common culture. This is 15 years ago. So Newsweek is already focused on the adolescence. Again, that neoteny was that the brain being undeveloped at birth is developing postnatally. I see, Miles, you're taking a good look at this picture because you're thinking about your children right now. Yeah, right. And the damage that you're doing. I'm just kidding. Okay, next slide, please. And in the same year, National Geographic said, oh, wow, this is good. So why don't we study monks? Why don't we study people who have really disciplined themselves in various forms of mindfulness? So think about that. That's 15 years ago. Okay, if we go to the next slide, please. Okay, Miles, you might be familiar with this. This is a very famous passage from the Majjhima Nikaya, the earliest Buddhist texts. And by the time we get to 2013, just to show how this has developed, I'm looking in my hand right now at a journal published by the National Institute of Health. The title of it is Cognitive and Emotional Control of Pain, and its disruption in chronic pain. There are 183 citations in this review from NIH. And I'm saying all this just to say what I'm about ready to show you in the next slide, or excuse me, in the next video, don't go there yet. But what I'm about ready to show you is to take this understanding of evolution and our nervous system to a whole nother level. In this particular passage, I just found it interesting. On the arising of this, that arises. On the cessation of this, that ceases. I'm going to ask you to consider something pretty bizarre here, but our nervous system functions with the firing of individual neurons. And neurons will not fire unless their action potential is upset enough to cause the nerve cell to polarize and depolarize. Without that, the nerve signal won't go down an axon. And what's interesting about this is I'm sure Siddhartha was not thinking of neuroanatomy, but the degree to which things occur dependently cannot be underestimated. So to that end, I'd like to show you another 2-minute video, if I could please. And this is on the 5 phases of nociceptic pain. Okay, before you start the video, let me just explain one thing. The 5 phases are going to include 2, transmission and modulation. It's very short, but I'd like you to pay particular attention to the phases transmission and modulation as you see this graphic. It's very short, so please go ahead and roll the video.
Nociceptive pain occurs as a result of the activation of the nociceptive system by noxious stimuli, inflammation, or disease. Nociceptive pain proceeds through 5 phases: transduction, conduction, transmission, perception, and modulation. Nociceptive pain originates in the nociceptors, which are highly specialized primary sensory neurons found primarily in the skin or joints or the walls of organs. These receptors convert noxious stimuli into electrical current through a process called transduction. The current is then conducted along the nociceptor axons to their cell bodies, located in the dorsal root ganglion in the spinal cord, and then to their central terminals located in the dorsal horn. Here, the electrical impulses initiate neurotransmitter release from nociceptor central terminals, which relay the signal across synapses to the dorsal horn neurons. Greater stimulus intensities are associated with the release of neuropeptides, including substance P, from central terminals of C fibers. Substance P, acting via neurokinin receptors located on dorsal horn neurons, generates a greater postsynaptic response. The signal is then relayed via ascending nociceptive pathways to higher centers in the brain, where it is perceived as pain. Ascending nociceptive transmissions are modulated by inhibitory or facilitatory control systems in the dorsal horn of the spinal cord. The process of inhibition and facilitation is regulated by neurons projecting from the nucleus raphe magnus in the lower brainstem. Nociceptive signals are transmitted through descending projections in the dorsal horn of the spinal cord.
Just checking, can you see the video?
No, it went out. That's okay, just for time purposes, I'll just...
Inhibition may serve to provide analgesia at times of danger so that pain does not compromise function.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, apologies. Something happened there, so we lost that. So I'm just gonna continue just for time purposes. I asked if you would focus on the notions of transmission and modulation. Mm-hmm. The important takeaway here, and I could talk about this for a long time, but I won't, but it's important for people to understand that in the dorsal horn, in a part of the spinal column called the substantia gelatinosa, where the first order neuron transmits, hence the word transmission, to the second order neuron, where neurotransmitters serve as a gate control. It's referred to as the gate control theory of pain. How does that actually happen? Neurotransmitters are what? The signaling molecules used at the synaptic junction that pass a signal from a neuron to its target cell. Signals that cross this synaptic junction here is where the polarization is key. There's an action potential. And here, there's either an excitatory ion or inhibitory ions that converge to fire or not, thus passing along a certain threshold of polarization and depolarization event. That creates a chain reaction that allows the nerve signal to continue. There's an ascending pathway and a descending pathway. The modulation that can occur through learning and behavior is that you can increase that inhibitory response such that the neurotransmitters of enkephalon at the synaptic junction actually serve as a gate to block the transmission of that nerve signal. So with training, and of course people are going to ask about this in great detail, as they should, but it is one of the things that you can do to influence whether or not that nerve signal passes on in an excitatory way, which is what happens when you have pain catastrophization and chronic pain, where your mind just cannot get off that pain. That actually means there's kind of a Darwinian selection process happening at the level of the neuron. And so you can either have a facilitation or excitatory response, which is there in our evolutionary history. It's good. If you have to run from that tiger, you want that. But on the other hand, if this, like a trauma victim, which I just really enjoyed a number of sessions on trauma, that trauma can cause catastrophizing such that your body literally shuts down. And so the idea is, how can you create inhibitory or a kind of natural analgesia that stops that pain signal from moving forward? Okay, that said, let's move to the PowerPoint again, please. Okay, one of the themes that has been talked about here, next slide, please, is the biopsychosocial model. In this case, I'm applying that biopsychosocial model to pain. When I say as felt pain, what I mean is the perception of pain is different in virtually all of us because of these three different factors: biological, psychological, and social. Next slide, please. Next slide, please.
Roma, you there?
Next slide, please.
Hello, Roma. Or Oscar, can you add Roma?
Just a second. Yeah, Roma's just lost her connection. She's trying to reconnect at the moment. Have you got the slides at all, Miles or David?
I have the slides, but.
Okay.
They're certainly not available now since we're on live.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah, David, Jaro had a question that's related to what you were saying.
Yes.
Does the modulation effect also, does the breathing also have an effect on the modulation effect?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you, Jaro.
Does breathing also have an effect on the modulation effect?
Breathing?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's one of the practices that you can do. Absolutely. Okay, next slide, please, if we're back.
There we are.
Okay, so this is just to explain a little bit further on the biological side of this biopsychosocial model. There could be injury, there could be a history of trauma, infection, illness, nerve damage. psychologically, if you have lots of anxiety, fear, have trouble sleeping, this is going to also affect your as-felt pain, social life. I think the people who are interested in embodiment, I think this is almost a no-brainer. If you think about it, we understand this. Next slide, please. And so this is important. If you start at the left where it says pain perception, these predispositional factors are going to contribute to that pain expression, what I'm calling as felt pain. If you have low fear, if you have a healthy lifestyle, all these activities going on, even though you're working with pain, you're managing the pain, that pain expression is going to be depressed, probably because of the inhibitory factors that are happening because of how you're directing your attention. If, on the other hand, you can't get your mind off your persistent chronic pain, you begin to catastrophize that. That leads to fear. That leads to fear of movement, called fear avoidance. Now suddenly you have loss of connection with other people and exercise, and there's a cycle of disability and depression that occurs. Next slide, please. And so when we talk about self-care, all the various modalities that I think the presenters here at this conference are encouraging us to do help us to not only get in touch with our bodies, but what I want to share that maybe people didn't realize is, with a little bit of focus and strategizing for those persons who are suffering from persistent chronic pain, then I think we've got something here that can really help people going forward, which I'm really excited about. Okay, next slide, please. Next slide, please. So this might seem silly, but Miles and I practice Aikido, and we know there's a basic concept of like keeping one point or keeping your center. You know, people throughout this conference are teaching people how to be centered and relaxed. And what I'm saying is that process of becoming centered and relaxed is teaching yourself to think differently. And you will get a different result when it comes to managing your pain. Inflammation and your as-felt experience of pain can be significantly reduced. Next slide, please. Okay, I'm going to go really fast here because I'm speaking kind of like Miles is my proxy for virtually everyone in the embodiment world here. Miles, when we teach, and we're teaching people how to unify their mind and body, I don't know about you, but I liken it to like something sweet. Let's say you've never tasted anything sweet before. You've never experienced the power of a unified mind and body. But I don't know if you agree with this, Miles, but I'm thinking other people who are teaching people to learn through their experience like this, that this is a modality that they might be able to adapt. As long as you're teaching people to experience the difference between being unfocused and focused, then that's all you need. And then you can transition it to managing pain. So I see you nodding, so I'm going to say that's a good. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so imagine an iceberg. When I talk about unifying your mind and body to manage chronic pain, I'm talking about using your whole iceberg so that your powers of concentration are going to be such that you're going to utilize the power of both your mind and body working together. And again, I think my discipline in Ki Aikido is not the only discipline where people are teaching how to harmonize. So next slide, please. Okay, we've already talked about this. So centering is a basic exercise that allows people to focus and feel relaxed. Next slide, please. When we're relaxed, we know that your skill will improve, right? When you're relaxed, F equals MA, right? Force equals mass times acceleration. Well, you can change the acceleration, for example, in the martial arts of your hand by being very relaxed. So I think people understand in the movement therapies and dance therapies that they know that movement and relaxation go together. So I'm thinking here's another opportunity for people to use their modality to manage chronic pain. Next slide, please. And then, Miles, of course, Aikido people know this idea of the unbendable arm, right? Extending ki. And we use this fire hose example. But if you are teaching a modality that allows people to concentrate all their energy in a single direction, this will also really, really help you in your quest to manage pain as I proceed here, and hopefully I'll have time to get through this. Okay, next slide, please. Okay. In 1979-80, I wrote my doctoral thesis, and that work is evidenced in this diagram. I developed what I call three orders of body-mind awareness that I think, Miles, you'll relate to absolutely immediately, as well as many other people. This is so simple. Third order awareness is how we are in daily life 99.9% of the time, right? Our experience of the world is as if our consciousness is directed. Directed where? From in here in our heads, where we say, this is me, Miles, and I'm looking at the computer screen or my notes or what have you, and your worldview is always located, if you will, where you are, and you're sensing the world outside you. This is called third order awareness. It's normal, but your mind tends to jump around from thing to thing to thing in daily life. Second order awareness, I think many people are teaching this, you may not have that term in your toolkit, but I call it second order awareness, is when you're only focusing on one thing. You don't have monkey mind anymore, you're relaxed. And what really helps those who teach meditation, like Miles and many others here, is that the object of your meditation is not a static X, but usually when we're training, the object of our meditation is dynamic. That's like a mantra, a sound that continues, mudras, which are hand postures that continues, mandalas, which are diagrams used in meditation that have a certain flow to them, because your mind wants to move. And that's why third order is so common. It's just bouncing around everywhere. But when we learn to meditate and focus our, or it could be breathing, meditation, or other repetitious practices, we are really learning the skill of focusing and sustaining that focus. And then finally, when you do that so well, like everything else in daily life, you're able to acquire the skill of habituating a practice so well that that intention is no longer necessary. And when we talk about certain flow states, I call it first order body-mind awareness, where there's no intentionality whatsoever. You're not directing your consciousness. You are just, as we say, presencing things as they are. It's a qualitatively different experience that I think people with significant practice in breathing and meditation and other inner disciplines are very familiar with. Let's see if we can use this model to help us to manage pain. Next slide, please. Okay. Now I'm identifying what I call three elements. The three elements are identify in number one, that is to notice the debilitating reactions to pain in your life. The second element is learning how to direct your mind and body to manage symptoms of pain that occur in daily life activities. In other words, you're learning to develop a kind of second order experience well enough that you can get off the pain that is speaking to you and put your mind on something else. In the peer review literature, so I'm not making this up, this is called focused attention, and first order body mind awareness in the scientific literature, they call it open monitoring. It allows us to relax and accept, kind of like an acceptance commitment theory for some of you who know that. And then finally, you want to maintain focus, sustain the focus, because otherwise it's just a one-off and you're right back to experiencing pain. So let's examine how these elements can influence this process. Next slide, please. So in Living with the Wind at Your Back and what I'm making available to you as a free download, there are 14 different exercises. We don't have time to go into them today, but just imagine exercises that would include things like breathing and meditation that don't require anything other than yourself and being with other people. No dojo, no membership, no special training. You can do this all the time, these 14 exercises. But essentially what you're doing is over time, you're recognizing, you're asking yourself to notice. just being mindful. We call it mindfulness, right? To identify and to accept. How do you feel? Where is your mind? And if we're focusing on exercises having to do with managing pain, then obviously this is the context that we're noticing. Where is the pain? How do I feel? Sharp, dull? What's really going on? Because the emphasis is you are not your pain. It's just a sensation that you are experiencing. It's not your entire identity. Once you notice, then you can change, provided you learn the skills of focusing. And finally, you can sustain that focus once you develop that skill more. So if you get the idea, let's continue to bake this. Next slide, please. Okay, so let's talk about the skills and the elements. So when you're talking about focus, you're asking yourself, where is your mind when you're performing a task? Then where are you going to direct your attention? And how are you going to sustain that concentration? And by the way, let me see if I can find it here. I just noticed the word attention there. I have to say in this conference, and Miles, I watched your session with Susan Piver.
Okay.
And her lasting comment, hers was on Buddhist wisdom and relationships. And she ended the whole thing saying, you know what love is? You know what working on a relationship is ultimately? She said, attention. Attention is the key to love. And she uses her meditation practice to focus that attention in managing loving relationships. And then Richard Strassi Heckler Sensei, he ended his presentation saying, you know what we're really doing? We're training our attention, because energy follows attention. And then Peter Levine, talking about trauma, he basically said, we have to direct our attention to our body awareness to learn how to relax in this process of expansion and contraction to essentially heal those traumas. And I found that this whole notion of focusing your attention is so common in the embodiment world. I'm excited to just say, think about that with persons who are suffering from chronic pain, and how that focus of attention might dramatically improve the quality of their life. Mm. Same thing, it's all about noticing. With relaxation, where do you hold tension? And are you able to change that? You know, a common one I've heard, and Miles and I talk about it all the time, if I'm up here talking to you like this, obviously it looks like I've got tension in my shoulders. If I can just notice that and then relax, well, that changes my state in ways that will really help me to manage pain. Similarly with connection, first you have to be aware of how you're responding to others. And when you're in pain, it's very difficult to even think about other people. But with training, with a process that helps you to know why you might want to put your mind on other loved ones, other people, even if you're just chopping vegetables, whatever it is, mindfully attend to what you do so that you can get off the focus on your as felt pain. It's worked for me for 51 years, and I didn't even have all this figured out yet. I just followed my teacher. He said, do you want a bright, happy life or a dark, gloomy one? I'd say, sensei, bright and happy. And then he said, okay, so don't think about it. So when I go to doctors and they look at my x-rays and the MRI and they say, how is it you're not screaming in pain with every step you take? Because it's bone on bone between your talus and your foot and your tibia are just scraping. The whole thing is just scraping. And I'd say, I don't think about it. But I don't think that's a very good strategy to try to teach other people to just say, oh, don't think about it. That's not very helpful. So next slide, please. I'm trying to get a kind of system around this to help help people. Okay, so with my proposal here is with developing the skill of focus, relaxation, and tension, you're going to effectively manage your pain, reduce inflammation, reduce dependence on opioids if you've had to take them, and with increased mobility, you're going to increase the quality of your life living with pain. Next slide, please.
Oh. There we go.
Okay, and then it's got two more. Hit it again and again, please. That's it. So I want to introduce the idea now. I'm looking at the clock. Next, you can click it again. Yeah. So there's a connection here between repetitive practice, okay, daily life practice. When you're in pain, if you're like me, it's 24/7. It doesn't go away. It doesn't take a day off. So it's the daily practices that are going to create new habits and new behaviors because of your improvement in your ability to develop the skill of focus, relaxation, and connection. But for me, so it's not just like, okay, David, that's good for you. You should be in pain, but you're not. But I don't really understand, is this really going to work for other people? The good news is it has, and I've taught a number of sections of people all in their over 70, actually, persons with a lifetime of chronic pain, both in 2018 and 19. And so I wanted to be sure that we had some kind of pre and post testing with the training. So if I could have the next slide, please. In fact, just for time, what I'm gonna do, I'm gonna skip over something, some of these, next slide, please. I'm just looking at the clock, next slide, please. Okay, I'm gonna hold here because this slide right here has elements of the two that I just skipped for time. So common metrics used in cognitive behavioral therapy and acceptance commitment therapy are pain interference, another called satisfaction with life, pain intensity, impact of depression, committed action, and fear avoidance. What I've done here is I've developed a scale of 10 questions there where you're answering it almost never, you know, all the way to very often. And there are questions here. My thoughts are scattered when I'm in pain. I can focus my attention on other things when I'm in pain. You know, almost never, very often, that kind of thing. So it's possible to develop pre and post questionnaire, just 10 questions. And then these questions reflect the skill focus. So if we go to the next slide, please, I hope I'm not confusing you trying to give you too much. But in this particular slide, you can see that there are three questions having to do with focus. The presupposition is if you undergo some training, your answers to the questions, these three questions on focus, are going to be different, you know, after the training. I did it for 5 weeks, 5 sessions once a week, like a 2-hour session once a week, 5 sessions. Similarly, there are three other questions that speak to relaxation, you can see it there, and connection. And not only that, but the identify, direct, and sustain element also go along with these measures. So there's a lot of thought that's gone into how to develop questions and measures that are accepted in the rehab pain world, and then to link it to the skills and even the elements of learning how to notice, that is identify, redirect your mind towards more positive outcomes, and then to be able to sustain that over time. Okay, next slide, please. So just to wrap up then, with improved focus, you're helping people to eliminate the habit of catastrophizing their as-felt pain. By helping people to relax, there's another measure called pain intensity. When you relax, that pain intensity is significantly reduced. And finally, if you're able to connect with other people in your activities in your daily life, then you're going to have improved quality of life. Next slide, please. So at the end of the day, with all this training, people make these decisions consciously or unconsciously at all times. And I always encourage my students here, let's say you're a person who is suffering from persistent pain. You have to ask yourself, what are you going to focus on? What does it mean when you focus on that? How do you feel and what are you going to do? It's taking responsibility for your role, your intentional role, to essentially develop behavioral learning habits. They're going to help you to enhance that inhibitory function right there, as I described before, such that you're going to be reducing literally the firing, the continued transmission of pain signals that are not necessary. It's chronic, it's persistent. You don't have to go into fight or flight and catastrophization. Makes a huge difference in the world. And finally, I think the very last slide, thank you for your patience, everyone, as we go through this. I encourage everyone to please write to me at managingpain@davidshaner.com. That's an email. I'd be happy to send you this PowerPoint presentation and the video links if you like. If you go to davidshaner.com, the homepage, and click on Living with the Wind at Your Back, it'll take you to a book page. And there you can download for free the 14 exercises that I've been talking about, as well as what I call the 7 cards that explain kind of the logic, because these exercises are not just hit and miss, they're sequential and they build on each other. So the logic of why these exercises and how is it helping you, why are you doing it, is all outlined in those cards. And then finally, again, if you're interested in living with the wind at your back, that's the same book order page right there. It's a self-published, so I invite you to do that if you like. But I did my best, Miles, to try to try to get it in.
Well, that's totally it's totally great, David. And so I just want to let everybody know that you can ask if you have any questions for David. You can type them in the chat. Of course, Jaro, he's here in the, he's here in the room, so he can. He actually had a question before that, that David didn't get a full chance to answer. But I would also love to maybe touch on Yaro's question about breathing, breath, and maybe some of the exercises that you recommend for.
Yes, well, two of the exercises, exercise 8 and 9, are breathing, and it's the breathing method taught by my teacher. It's called Kino Kokuho, Koichi Tohei, founder of Shinshin Tohei Aikido. So I'm teaching that breathing exercise. Also, the next exercise on key meditation, we call Kino Seizoho, is also taught by my teacher, Koichi Tohei Sensei. So breathing and meditation are key, and they're in the middle there. But it starts, for example, Miles, the very first exercise is developing what I call a personal development affirmation. In the book, Living with the Wind at Your Back, it's not a book that's specializing in managing pain. It's just learning how to live with your mind and body unified. But the very first exercise is to develop a goal. In Japanese, what we call a tenshoku. And the goal would be, what is it? What kind of affirmation can you say to yourself that you can go back to throughout the day when you're managing pain? I'll tell you what mine is, and I've put it there in the very first exercise. It's got to be very simple and memorable, and it's called half, half, half. Half, half, half. I see Yaro, you're nodding. Yeah, it makes sense, right? You're just releasing and relaxing into the trauma of as felt pain. So I think this idea of relaxing and releasing, maybe even visualizing, like if the pain is in your ankle and you see a candle there, you're just half reducing the flame, reducing the flame, reducing the flame, for no other reason that than you can with your intentional experience. And when you begin to habituate and practice this 24/7, you're changing, I believe you are literally changing the wiring of your brain with respect to responding to that particular source of chronic pain. You know, if I'm hit somewhere else in the body, I'm still going to experience pain and react. But with respect to my ankle pain, I honestly don't feel it that much. I mean, it throbs and whatnot, but it's utterly manageable. And I think it's because of simply learning these exercises. Very quickly, Miles, another is exercises. Take a breath before you speak. Stop the habit of reactive speech. So if you're learning to sit in silence, even for 5 minutes a day, use that. When you want to react to someone, that reactionary self is not helping you to manage your pain. So by simply taking a breath before you speak and speaking mindfully, another exercise, before you act, take a breath and think about it before you act. And so if you always have that development affirmation in your head, it can be a check. Are you living in accord with your affirmation, or are you not paying attention and as a result exacerbating your experience of as felt pain?
All right, so dropping into the moment. I mean, I was just thinking, as you said that, I was thinking of my daughter, the young one, the three-year-old, and she, yep. You know, she's speaking a lot these days, but it's not always clear. It's not always so clear what she's saying, because mm-hmm. she's still, you know, developing her language. But I realized that if I just actually stop and breathe and just be with her, it all, everything comes back into balance.
Exactly.
And then the understand, it's almost like development just starts to unfold in a very natural way. But if I'm not there with her, and this is a bit more relational, I suppose, if I'm not there with her, then we're missing each other completely.
Exactly.
And you know, whatever, I do my own thing, but she's the one that gets left behind because I disconnect from her. And that's the same situation with pain, I would think.
Exactly. And that's really the bottom common denominator here. I think people, participants and speakers at this conference are all over this. Everyone's teaching focus, relaxation, and connection. And if they recognize, even if they've never experienced persistent pain, a chronic pain. Once they recognize, holy cow, you've got something in your toolkit that with some, a little bit of understanding and some metrics, you might surprise yourself on how the skills that you are currently teaching might help others with their self-care, right? I'm not a medical doctor describing anything, but with respect to self-care, I think this is an extremely, the skills you teach your students can be extremely empowering, especially for, you know, we talk about persons with trauma or something else that they're working on. Well, pain is trauma. So everything that's probably relevant to dealing with the history of trauma in your life and the buildup in your neural networks that might cause you to shut down with certain triggers, there's hope. There's the possibility that with a certain level of acceptance, I always have to accept I'm going to be in a certain level of dull pain. If I choose to focus on it, I can feel the clicking in my ankle with every step. But you know what? I've been doing martial arts, Aikido, for 51 years, and it doesn't really inhibit me at all.
Well, that's what I was. We have about one more minute, so I'm going to give you this, and then you can do with it what you may. Let's say besides trauma for a moment, because that's a complex issue. Let's just say with physical pain, these type of exercises that you're talking about, they'll increase, certainly in meditation, but they'll increase the person's pain threshold.
Not the pain threshold, because I'm not saying mind over matter. I'm saying what you're going to do is create a reaction that when habituated is literally going to serve the descending pain signal down those axons. You're going to be able to modulate and thus inhibit between the first order and second order neuron that transmission going back up the ascending pathway. I know it's hard to follow, but...
No, but I got it. So when you change your relationship to the pain, consciously, intentionally, the pain changes its relationship to
you. Yes, what you're doing is actually producing enkephalon, which is a neurotransmitter in that area of the dorsal horn that's going to serve to kind of stabilize, that is, so that the neuron does not hit its action potential. You're basically going to close certain gates that are going to inhibit ion flow, that's going to inhibit that neuron from firing. The net result is the as experienced pain, which you experience in your somatosensory cortex, is going to be reduced.
And since this is not mind over matter that you're talking about, it's healing. It's actually healing. Going through the process of healing.
Yes, it's once you understand the process, then you understand what am I supposed to notice? How do I develop the skill to change the direction of my attention, right? And that's what meditative teachers teach is how to move from a third order to a second order to a first order mode of consciousness.
It even works in instant pain, I guess. If you have instant pain and you make it have, and that's become your first reaction to pain, you learn to relax immediately to that pain and the pain just flows away. It's there, but it's not that strong. It's not binding.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but we're coming to the end and I've got a couple of announcements I've got to make. And I'm really sorry about that. So listen, David, I will pass it back to you for the final word. And if you have a top tip to share with us, although you've shared so many. To find out more, David already mentioned it, but to find out more, I'm placing this in the chat box now to find out more about David Shaner and especially for his book Living with the Wind at Your Back. Go to www.davidshaner.com. And David has been graciously, anybody who's interested in managing pain, he's graciously offered for you to contact him directly via email at managingpain@davidshaner.com. Our next session will be in 1 hour from now. It's with Vladimir Vasiliev of Sistema, and he'll be teaching on the secret to self-defense and health. So I want to remind everybody that we also have the coffee rooms are this wonderful feature for the Embodiment Conference. So just as Yaro, I unfortunately had to cut him off. We can all go over to the coffee room and we'll be put into a room and you can unpack the sessions that you've been participating in today and share with the other members of the Embodiment Conference community. Also, I want to invite everybody to join the Embodiment Conference Facebook group The links are in the chat and in the Facebook group. That's where everybody, the community, comes together. We share a lot of discussions and things going on there. This session has been recorded. It will be available for free for the next 48 hours. You'll be able to find it on the Embodiment Conference portal. After 48 hours, it is taken down. The Embodiment Conference has been a total labor of love with an incredible team. For a full year, they've been working hard on putting this together. And not only has it been an amazing team, but there has been a considerable amount of resources to put this together, and all totally free for the world. In order to actually support the production of this event, there is a library for sale. It's a wonderful investment in embodiment. It's a wonderful way to actually support this work, so more of these types of conferences could be brought to everybody for completely free. And when you're investing in the Embodiment Conference, remember, you're investing in your own embodiment future. And with that, David, it's back to you. Final words?
You are really good at this. Very good. So thank you, Miles, for joining me in today's session. Yero, thank you for your questions. Roma and Oscar, thank you for the tech support. Tom Burden, channel manager, thank you very much. I know I was asked to give a last something, and it just occurs to me, why don't I just talk about the elements? When you're practicing self-care, managing pain, you can be taught how to notice, and specifically what to notice mentally, physically. Then you'll be taught how to direct. So if you can learn to direct your consciousness and to sustain that consciousness, then basically you're well on your way to self-care, significantly reducing your as-felt pain. And thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Dr. David Shaner, and thank you, everybody, for joining. And everybody, please enjoy the rest of the Embodiment Conference.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Pleasure.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, Miles.
Absolutely. I've stopped the live share to Facebook. So we're done. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Roma.
Beautiful session.
Thank you, Miles. I look forward to seeing your session.
Hey, great. Oh, great. Fantastic. Yeah. Be happy to have you there. All the best.
All right. Thank you, sir.